Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with journalist Sevan McDonald and psychiatrist and researcher Cole Marta about the therapeutic use of psychedelics, in particular the treatment of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, with MDMA or ecstasy. Now, let me introduce first. I've been doing these conversations since the mid-90s when I took a hiatus in 2014. But after Trump's Electoral College victory, I felt I needed to deal with the causes, the repercussions, and the response in some new interviews. And this is the 31st such interview. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book, No Is Not Enough, David K. Johnston on the daily work of the Trump administration, etc. And the show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Now, a plug for participation. Let me offer you a few websites with information on how to confront the Trump agenda and work toward the healthy and just future we all need. The biggest one is IndivisibleGuide.com. That's one word, Indivisible Guide. Got about 5,000 local chapters around the country. Another national one is OurRevolution1word.com, Our, O-U-R, Revolution. That's the organization that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Two that were primarily digital but are now working closely with grassroots are MoveOn.org, MoveOn.org, that's national, and CourageCampaign.org, that's in the state of California, CourageCampaign.org. And two that are very specific are Five Calls, that's the number five and the word calls, fivecalls.org, which tells you some calls that are relevant and timely for you to make to your representatives, and Town Hall Project, all those words together, townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representatives are coming nearby to meet with constituents, and you can actually make your voices known to them. And you can email me at temcnally@mac.com if you want more info on that sort of thing. Now to today's guest. Did you know that LSD and psilocybin are being taken to ease the anxiety of life-threatening illnesses such as late-stage cancer in government-sanctioned studies? And that's not all. Other research is ongoing in the treatment of alcoholism and, as I said, PTSD. Psychedelic substances have been used for ceremony and as medicine for millennia. And such properties were being cultivated and studied in the U.S. in the 60s and even the early 70s, until widespread and careless use of psychedelics and sensational media reports produced a backlash. But over the last several years, and for quite a while under the radar, such use and study has begun again. Interest was growing, and due to the strong and consistent efforts of a fairly small community of foundations, researchers, and psychiatrists, research has been building. But I think a huge shift is happening right now, due in large part to the publication of Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind. In its 11 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, it was once at least as high as four. It might even have been higher. It's currently number four in the LA Times bestseller list. Pollan, a best-selling author whose last few books were about food, has written a big book that tells the story of the research as well as his personal experience of guided sessions with psychedelics. It offers an inviting prospect of the possibility of significant improvement in the quality of people's lives through the wider use of psychedelic substances. I came across an article by Sevan McDonald that she wrote for Playboy about her personal experience with the therapeutic use of MDMA to treat PTSD. We talked, and Sevan led me to Cole Marta, MD, who's leading an LA-based study of that treatment. As a journalist, Sevan McDonald has written for Details, Nylon, Playboy, Marie Claire, Paper, and her column 24/7 at the LA Weekly was named Best Column in the Nation by the Association of Alternative Media. Cole Marta is a psychiatrist in private practice in LA, where his clinic specializes in ketamine treatment for depression. He's also the founder of New School Research that conducts clinical trials with a focus on psychedelic research. He's the principal investigator at the Los Angeles site of phase 2 and 3 trials with MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD for the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, M-A-P-S. And he works with the Zendo Project in psychedelic harm reduction. Welcome, Sevan McDonald and Cole Marta, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, August 8th, 2018.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Terrence, for having us.
And I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So I'd like each of you, in your own words, to tell us a bit about your path to the work that you find yourself doing today, and feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. Cole.
Sure. I guess you could say I'm sort of a second generation. My parents were deadheads, and I grew up listening to bootleg tapes of Terrence McKenna lectures and things like that. So when I went to medical school and I was trying to decide what to do, I thought that the study of how chemicals affected consciousness was something that was actually covered by neurology, but I found out that that's the field of psychiatry, and that's sort of how I came about to study psychiatry. So once I chose psychiatry as a specialty, I actually looked up the organization MAPS, which I'd heard about when I was growing up, and found out that they were working towards this MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD project. But it was still several years off, and luckily I still had to do a residency training program, so I was still a few years off. And I connected with them early in my residency training program, and have been sort of aligning my ship to intersect with theirs. And they told me that in order to try to have a site in Los Angeles, I would need to publish some papers and do as much research as I could, because to their knowledge, there was nobody interested in leading a site in Los Angeles. So I started doing as much research as I could on psychedelics, published some papers on ibogaine and ketamine for depression, and stayed in touch, and here I am. Now we've made it happen, and we have a site in Los Angeles for MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD, and it's a long dream come true.
Very good. And briefly, we'll come back to it in much more detail later, but you're in stage three at this point?
We're about to start stage three, yeah.
And just for people who don't quite know stage one, stage two, stage three, explain that to folks.
Sure. So the FDA process has three stages to bring a drug to market. That's for psychiatry, at least. It can vary from specialty to specialty. But phase one is basically to establish safety of a drug. Early safety research was done by Charlie Grobe here in Los Angeles.
Charlie Grobe's been a guest on this show at least two or three times over the many years.
He's awesome, and he was somebody that I met with early in my residency training program, so he's been a mentor to me. So phase one is to establish the safety of the drug. Phase two is the first time that you actually test whether or not your drug is useful for what you expected the drug to be useful for. So that's the first time you're actually giving study drug to people who are suffering from a condition. The phase two data is in and is promising enough that we're starting phase three. It's the final stage. And the phase three is to gather more safety data and to demonstrate that the promising results in phase two are reproducible on a large scale.
Right. I get that. So the first time in phase two, you show, is there some efficacy? Is there some use to this? Does it seem to work?
Right.
But that's not good enough for science or the FDA. You want to be able to replicate that and show that wasn't just a fluke. It wasn't just those particular subjects or
exactly.
Something. Okay.
Exactly.
Very good. Seven.
I've been writing since I was 20. I stumbled into journalism career. I'll come back to that in a minute, but I've always written third person. I grew up in a house of writers and performers. I didn't actually attend consistent high school, though I did graduate because I was a child actress. So I was in and out of school. But when I was 21, I was asked to interview my father for Details magazine. My dad was a musician in the counterculture movement. He came out of the Haight-Ashbury psychedelic movement. So I was born...
For those, Country Joe.
That's right. So yeah. I was born in the Haight-Ashbury at the height of that moment, right after the Summer of Love. And my name is psychedelically inspired. And in this room, I think you guys understand what that means, though sometimes people don't, meaning that my parents did a lot of psychedelics. They were very young when they had me, and my dad named me Seven. That's my birth name. So I grew up around a lot of people that were doing psychedelics and trying to change the world and were artists. And I've done psychedelics myself in my youth. So when I was 20 years old, I knew an editor at Details Magazine. He asked me to interview my father, and I sort of, though I hadn't gone to college, I wrote that piece, and then they asked me to keep on writing. They put me in contract. It was a bit of an almost famous thing. My second thing was a cover story. And then I learned how to write by doing celebrity journalism, and I'm so grateful to all of my editors. There's so many. Susan Kittenplan at Harper's Bazaar, you know, Lori Ochoa at the LA Weekly. Anyway, I learned how to write that way. So I did celebrity journalism for years and years and years, and trend stuff and Hollywood stuff. And then eventually I got to move into other things, thanks to my time at the LA Weekly. I hadn't written for many years. I was doing other things. And I heard about this study. I heard about the data around this MAP study of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. And I thought it was very evocative. 50% of the people coming out of the study, having done three sessions with MDMA in a therapeutic setting, were no longer qualifying for being categorized as suffering from PTSD. I thought that was really interesting, and I reached out to Playboy and asked if I could write this piece. I should say, before I reached out to Playboy, I was introduced to Rick Doblin, who's not here, but... that's okay.
Wait, people may think that means he passed away.
Oh, no, he's not in the room.
He's not in the room. Yeah. He is on the planet.
Right. Yes. Sorry. So Rick Doblin runs MAPS, which is the organization that is sponsoring this study. So Rick Doblin and I were introduced through some friends, the late John Barlow. I'd like to give a shout out to you.
Yeah. Now, see, he has passed. Okay.
John Barlow has passed.
It was a foreshadowing.
Yes. So John Barlow is amazing in so many ways, but he also wrote for The Grateful Dead, and he was a friend of mine, and I knew he knew Rick, and he introduced me. So I was hired to write this piece, and I initially was writing it third person, which I do. And I was able to go meet the Mithoffers. They're a couple who trained all the doctors that will do this work in the clinical study, and they're amazing. And I interviewed some veterans who had been through the trial. And as I was writing this piece, it started to get very personal. It sort of was a perfect storm. In fact, I was in South Carolina when there was a storm, like an actual natural storm. And I started to realize that I was myself suffering from PTSD. And while I was interviewing the Mithoffers, who are amazing dream parents, I talk about them a bit in the piece, very safe, I'll say they're very safe, I didn't want to leave. And I wanted desperately to say, oh, take me into the study right now. And I didn't, because I'm forever a professional and enjoy very much and have taken great comfort in being the observer. So I think, though, it's a wonderful thing. I think I hide out in that space. And I wanted to seem professional. I wanted to respect Playboy. I didn't want to jeopardize the study. So anyway, I proceeded on. But as I was proceeding on, I was triggered, and I started suffering more and more. My cognitive abilities was fading, which has never happened to me. And I wrote the piece. As luck would have it, Playboy was going through a redesign, and so it sat for many, many months. In fact, a year. They paid me, it sat around. And in that time, I, in desperation, started looking in the underground to find some doctors to basically do the protocol, like because at that time the study was dormant. They were collecting data from phase two, and I couldn't submit myself for phase three because, as you see, it's starting now. This was a couple years ago. So I started to look in the quote-unquote underground for doctors, and I didn't want to ask the Mithoffers because I didn't want to jeopardize their study. And I was able to find two doctors, because that's the protocol. So it's a male and a female, which is amazing. And I had to find one that was a psychiatrist, and if the other one wasn't, it was fine. But they would be able to do three sessions, which that's the study. Three sessions spaced apart by 3 weeks.
Let me make clear, I think, that you are not getting into the study. What you're setting out to do is find a way to do a similar set of experiences as if you were in a study, but you're doing it for healing, for self-healing.
So I was in this unusual situation. I believed in the data. I met these people. I met veterans who had had amazing recovery. You can read about that in my piece or other places on MAPS. And I could trust these two doctors, which at that point I wasn't trusting anybody. And I liked the scientific aspect of it. I was very interested, I should say, in the male-female team, because what that allows for is corrective experiences with the mother and father or the male and female. That was beautiful and sophisticated and whole to me. I've done a lot of therapeutic work, and I am happy to share about that. But
here you were. You've done, and I know from the article, you've done a number of modes of treatment that are usually used with anxiety and depression and so on, and yet here you found yourself, none of them had lasted.
That's right. And so here I am in South Carolina in the middle of a storm with the beautiful Mithoffers and their dog and their wonderful office and these veterans whose lives have turned around literally from living in a box to dream idyllic life with dolphins. And seriously, there was like dolphins outside the interview with the one veteran. And I'm experiencing all the symptoms like noise, sound. And I start to feel kind of like an animal that knows that a certain plant is going to help. Like, I'm like, I need that medicine. I need that medicine. Nothing else is going to work, I should say. So I've been in therapy, in and out of talk therapy since I was 11. I've been in AA since I was 20. I had a few years of pretty wild drug use. That's another story I'm happy to talk about, but maybe another time. And I've been an active member in the 12-step program world since I was very young, never had a legal drink, and still am. And I have seen a lot of shamans. I've lived in two ashrams. I've been given two names by different gurus. I lived in a yurt. I'm a certified yoga teacher. I was going to be a brahmachari, which is basically a renunciate, a monk in a Vedic community. I've done a lot of things, and I knew that really I needed a miracle to use a great, it's not a Barlow line, I don't think, but it's to use a dead line. And it seemed to be that this was the miracle, but I couldn't enter the study. So again, I go around in the underground, and like literally the wheels are falling off leading up to me finding these two doctors that were willing to do it. So I found two doctors who actually didn't know each other before I introduced them. They agreed, which was, I was so grateful to do it. And they did it according to the MAPS protocol.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in my house with my dog.
And what year was this?
I think this was 3 years ago.
Okay.
It was in 2015 and 16.
Okay. Just sort of to see that we're now 3 years past that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So then I was able to do it. The protocol, that is.
And your experience.
And have that experience. And then, as luck would have it, Playboy pops back up and says, hey, would you update this piece for an issue? And I was like, yeah. You know, since then, I did this study. Would you like, and I was so frightened to do this, would you like a first-person thing? And of course they would, but they were sensitive to say, if you don't want to share. And I had only a week's time to turn it in, which was a blessing because it forced me to just do it.
Yeah, instead of thinking about
it. So then I shared a bit of my own personal thing, and that's how we got here.
Your experience is what I asked you about. Your experience having gone through those three sessions.
I can talk a bit about that. First of all, I hope that I really made it clear that I have done lots of other work, and I respect all that work. And I don't know that this is right for everybody. Let me just say that. I also want to say one other thing. I don't think that there's anything that is shaktipat, or which is a word like you open up your third eye and you're suddenly realized, or you wave a magic wand and you're suddenly healed. I don't, from my own personal experience and from my life, I don't think anything is the answer, and then you never have to look back and you can just go to Pottery Barn and have a nice day and never think about yourself again. That being said, this work changed my life. It got me out of the state that I was in and helped me get back on my feet. I do want to say something about my abuse, if I may, in a general way. I was the victim of early, very early, childhood sexual abuse and chronic neglect, which I get into a bit in the piece. This was both in my family and in my extended family. And so my issues that contribute to my PTSD are elaborate and not the same as maybe somebody who witnessed a a murder.
Yeah, there's lots of ways to get traumatized.
And it affects my relationships with humans because the people that I was supposed to trust. Anyway, so it's a complex situation that I'm having more and more respect for every day. And I want to say one more thing about that. I personally, because I was the victim of early abuse, I am constantly finding and discovering new information about that. There is a lot of recall that happens in my life, and you don't necessarily know when it's going to take bloom. And that's a little bit different. And it's, I think anything that can help me or anyone like me understand and get that information allows us to have deeper roots for a more grounded life.
Mm-hmm. It sort of changes the way that you encounter life the next day.
Well, I think that there's a teacher that once said this, Jesus, I think said it, is that you want to build your house on steady ground. And I think for me personally, I knew something about my history, but I didn't know all of my history. And one thing that psychedelics also can do is help open the doors, specifically MDMA.
What is it about MDMA that makes it a treatment for PTSD, that you had the success in stage two, and that Seven had the personal success in her life where other things hadn't worked? What's going on there?
Right. So there are a handful of theories, but I think the predominant one and one that holds the most water is coming from the fMRI studies that were done. fMRI studies showed that people who were given MDMA compared to people who were given placebo had a decreased activity in the area of the brain called the amygdala, which is responsible for like our fear responses and negative emotion in general. And the MDMA caused a decrease in blood flow to that region of the brain and an increase in blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, which is where we have like complex processing and our character and higher executive functions of the brain. And so by actually decreasing this fear response, that it's almost like with PTSD, traumatic experiences get kind of trapped behind this wall of difficult emotional experience. And every time these particular memories come up or get triggered, also comes with it this sort of protective wall of fear and anger. So that material gets difficult to access. And actually, the reasonable person starts to just avoid those situations that remind them of those experiences. And so MDMA has this sort of almost lock and key kind of fit where it decreases the the amygdala so you can access those memories, and actually stimulates the prefrontal cortex. So not only can you actually process this content, you can process it with more clarity.
Now, it sounds like what you're speaking about there is MDMA in therapy.
Right.
In other words, MDMA, obviously there are many people taking it outside of therapy.
That's right.
And I would say on a wide continuum, from people who might be taking it, you know, to get crazy at a rave,
sure,
to people who are taking it very consciously, but not in a therapeutic setting. What is it that goes on in the brain? In other words, what you were saying, I think, was if you have experiences in your past that you avoid, that you can bring them up when you're in the MDMA experience, right, because of what you suggested, the same experience comes up, the memory comes up, or you bring it up, but you aren't overcome by fear, in fact, because of what's been reduced in the amygdala. And in fact, you can begin to see things and put things together,
right,
because now you're accessing that experience with a better flow of the prefrontal cortex.
Right.
But what I was saying is, I'm not taking it if someone isn't taking it with that setting and they aren't attempting to bring up hidden traumas, what's going on in the brain then?
Right. So those studies were actually done on people, excuse me, who were sitting in MRI machines. So they weren't undergoing therapy. And so that's happening to everybody who takes the MDMA.
Okay.
The lock and key is in the therapeutic setting, working with people with PTSD.
And what is the effect of MDMA on serotonin?
So it has powerful effects on serotonin in a number of ways.
And explain to listeners what serotonin is. It's a neurotransmitter, but
right. Specifically.
Serotonin
is one of our primary neurotransmitters, and it's kind of serves a funny function. It's not necessarily like a happy neurotransmitter. Like dopamine is more like the reward neurotransmitter, but serotonin certainly affects our moods. We know that by altering serotonin with different sort of drugs like SSRIs, those are the mainline antidepressants, for example. And what they seem to be, I think the best sort of description I have for what it's more involved in is sort of how you feel you're doing. Like it's sort of like your self-assessment.
Mm-hmm.
More than
so that
like
you're distinguishing
happy
that,
or sad.
Yeah, dopamine, which is the hit of the dopamine transmitters, the hit we get, as you say, as a reward. Something happens, something new, a lot of times with novelty. And in fact, a whole other conversation is why people get addicted to video games, to even Facebook and so on, is that every time that little ding goes off and they've got a message, the brain is wired, it's novel and it's coming to me, it's attracted to me,
yep.
And so we get that dopamine hit. Mm-hmm. Serotonin, it feels to me, is less of the pop, 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 and it's more, when you experience serotonin, it's as you say, it's
a sense
mood.
Of well-being.
Yeah.
Right. And that you're doing well, doing okay. And that's kind of, you know, the difference between being sad and being depressed too. Like being sad is like, excuse me, the opposite of happy, whereas depressed is the opposite of like being excited about life, like wanting to be engaging in life.
And what the thing that I personally have experienced with MDMA, mm-hmm. And certainly in conversations I've had and reading I've done, it seems to enable acceptance.
Right.
Self-acceptance. Absolutely. And the acceptance of others and maybe hard truths and so on.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Yeah, some people call it an empathogen. So prior to its being made an outlaw drug in 1985, I believe it is, it was pretty popular in a small community of psychotherapists working with couples for that exact reason. And it makes sense with this, you know, decreased amygdala, increased prefrontal cortex thing that we talked about earlier too, you know, between couples talking about difficult issues that, you know, you know, there may be a lot of fear about, you know, what if we bring up this, you know, the forbidden issue in the marriage or something
right.
So,
and let me just tell people that the origins of MDMA, this is the pathway of origin, really. And I'm not talking about the existence of it, but the discovery of it and the discovery of its effects. Alexander Shulgin, who synthesized it, the chemist who synthesized MDMA and who synthesized many, many different formulas, even related to, he would tweak one little thing in a molecule and see what happened.
Yeah, he was brilliant.
And so he synthesizes MDMA. His wife, Anna Shulgin, is a therapist.
Right.
And they experience the acceptance feeling, the, you know, what we've just described, and she begins to use it in therapy, and that spread widely. And you said a small group, but I think it was thousands of therapists who were using it at that point, perhaps. And then it caught on, I believe it was in Texas. It became a party drug. And when it became a party drug, then, you know, then the authorities moved in and scheduled it. Is it Schedule 1?
Yeah, like emergency scheduling, I think is what they called it. And it went immediately to Schedule 1. And that's actually when MAPS was born.
Right. And let me explain that the unintended consequence of Schedule 1-ing, something which gives you great acceptance, is that, and something that makes you feel good, is that people still want it. Only now, instead of being able to get what was actually MDMA, they are buying it on the street. It is unregulated.
Dangerous.
It is verboten, and they are getting anything but MDMA.
Right.
When I mean, there have been whole organizations, Dance Safe, Zendo, and so on, who are working to try to keep people from that. But in fact, when people are at a rave and they're buying what they think is ecstasy or MDMA, they could be getting animal tranquilizers.
They could get anything. Yeah.
And so when you hear about the negative consequences of MDMA, is a very good chance. I'm not saying that that it could never happen, but it's a very good chance that it was not MDMA, that it was something else.
That's
there were also the conditions in which you ingest a substance, a psychoactive substance ingested when you are low on water, when you're dehydrated, when you're overheated. Those things which a rave might produce
is exactly the wrong
time to take even the right thing, but to take some messed up combination that's being sold to you.
Right.
Pretty
exactly.
fair assessment.
Absolutely. And, you know, MDMA isn't harmless either. You know, I would not necessarily, not recommend it in that setting because MDMA does increase core body temperature. It does, exacerbate dehydration and also has some other effects
on your actual water
absorption.
Speed the heart rate as well.
Right. And it actually causes a hormonal shift that leads to like more water retention. And so you can overdose on water kind of,
You've heard you're at a rave. You've heard that the bad thing is to run out of water. So you start and you can overdo
that. Just a quick note about the, the feeling of acceptance and connectedness too. Another part of the working model for how MDMA works is oxytocin. I think that's a big part of the picture. Oxytocin is the bonding molecule. It's released when a mother is nursing shortly after birth, and it's the feeling that you get. Actually, if you want to feel it, you can induce an oxytocin burst by hugging for 30 seconds continuously. If you hold a hug and hold an embrace for 30 seconds, you get
a release
of oxytocin.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the feeling of a kind mother hugging you, that's oxytocin.
So what you're saying is, so you've got serotonin working, but you also have oxytocin,
oxytocin
and something that's going to stimulate those two things.
right.
is going to put us in a good way.
Exactly.
I've been with Cole for quite a while. Seven.
I just want to add a couple things. So it is in 1984, there, in my research, it was an estimated 4,000 therapists were using this in assisted therapy sessions.
Yeah. I
also want to give a shout out to Leo Zaff, who was also responsible. He was also a psychiatrist and a friend of Shulgin's, and they termed him the Johnny Appleseed of MDMA. Mm. So he was also, he was going to retire, and then he said, oh no, I want to use this drug in my practice. So that's that. I'd like to speak from experience a little bit about the difference between taking MDMA socially, which I've done, and had a very positive experience with friends, and taking it
therapeutic.
May I?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So back to the brain activity and these yummy things that are flooding your system. Also prolactin, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Which is
yep.
which is what women experience when they're nursing. So mm-hmm. the nursing experience can be quite bonding for the mother and the baby,
yeah.
right?
Otherwise, we might not be here.
Right. So we yes. Goodness. So we're flooded with all these yummy things. For me, so I think I set the stage was that I was not doing well, to say the very least. I mean, really bad. I've never done worse than I finally, my therapist arrived at my house. In fact, the 3 weeks that I had to wait, because the protocol is just talk therapy for 3 weeks, that was very hard for me. So they arrive, you take the medicine, and the first of the three sessions was easy, which was nice, because the second was quite hard. So I could trust the process, but I will say that you're flooded with all this yumminess, and they're doing this unique non-suggestive work, doing this work where they're just holding the space. So there's a male and a female in the room. They're holding the space. And what that means is I was allowed to trust two people, by the end of these three sessions, which at that point I wasn't trusting anyone, not my closest friends or family. So that was a huge boon for me. And they're just there sort of telling you to come back to the subconscious and look at what's arising. They're not non-suggestive. They're not saying, oh, I've got an idea, Seven.
Yeah, are you having thoughts of this?
Yeah.
They don't do that.
Yeah, which is very unhelpful. So they're just there in the space. They're sharing the space with you, and you might uncover something. I mean, the way that I was told before I went into it is sort of the difference between somebody who's experiencing fight or flight, in heightened fight or flight, or someone who's on this drug, is like, if I was to ask you, Terrence, like, so you witnessed your mother being murdered. In a normal setting, you might do one of two things. You might start to become very distressed and be like, sped up, and I did, and triggered. Or you might be seemingly okay, but completely detached. Uh-huh. And now in the therapeutic setting, it's not productive. Neither is productive. It's a waste of your time. It's a waste of your money. You might leave that office. Let's say that was in a therapeutic setting. You're going to leave the office possibly triggered, not even knowing it. And other things can happen. You can get in a car accident. And all of these things, these other things, is what PTSD is. It's sort of a series of more things, you know. Oh, then there's a car accident, then you lose your job, then you get in a fight with your girlfriend, and so on, and it becomes this cycle. So anyway, there's this optimum therapeutic situation with the drug, because you're sitting in a therapeutic setting, which is going to be like, I think, 4 to 6 hours, is that right? Is the sort of...
Yeah, the duration of the effects of the MDMA is somewhere between 4 and 6 hours.
Right, so also you're getting more time. You know,
you're saying relative to the normal therapy, which is usually an hour, unless
right.
we're in certain kinds of special workshops or certain kinds of
that's
situations,
correct.
It's an hour. And,
so,
and what you're suggesting is that to tap traumatic incidents, to tap traumatic emotions, and then have to leave the office 20 minutes later is a recipe for problems.
Yeah, and I think we could go over to Cole later to talk about his experience at the VA, maybe. But yes, I don't think, I think for me and for many people, I know doctors that work with children, that specialize in trauma with children. Children need a lot of time to talk and unravel what has happened to them. So I have all my baby children in me that haven't had a chance to heal, and now more so. They definitely showed up in the MDMA, but they need to take their time. And they and what happened for me, especially in that first session, which I share in Playboy, I did regress. Meaning I really took on the characteristics of an actual 7 year old, my 7 year old. And she was with us in the room, and she was so sweet, and she really led us to a lot of information in a really playful and magical way. And she was allowed to do that. I'd never seen her before, because she was in a room with safe people, and a man and a woman and my dog and some toys, and which I just happened to have. My sock monkey makes an appearance in the Playboy piece, and we could sort of see where she led us. And if I was just taking MDMA with you, no matter how well-meaning you are, and we were at your house or in a beautiful setting, at some point you might find it exhaustive, or your ego kicks in, or you've got an opinion, or I'm scared because you're a man and I've been raped sometimes. All those things will contribute it to now suddenly going from something helpful where we're like, oh, Terrence, isn't this fun, to it being unhelpful. So again, coming back to being in that room, you've got two people committed to you. You're safe. You're in a safe environment. And now real breakthroughs can happen, real discovery. And for children, I recently heard from a doctor, Dr. Astrid Hager, who works with childhood trauma. She said, when you're talking to children, it's best to use magic. So you say, you know, what if I could change one thing in your life? What would it be? Mm. And I think that, as we all know, anybody who likes psychedelics, whether therapeutically or recreationally, it gives us a bit of that magic. And I think that's also great because for me, there's a lot of little sevens that have been really hurt, and they hold the key. They need to feel safe for however long, and then they might say, you know what happened to me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Can I tell you what happened to me? I'm super scared, and I don't want to upset my parents, and I don't want you to arrest anybody, and I just want to tell you this information.
And that, what you're saying is, at that point, those kinds of experiences might take place.
They did take place for me.
Yeah.
They did take place for me, and I'm not saying that they're the end, but they did. In fact, the last session I had with my doctors, I remember that we were ending the session, and I said, you know, it's like I called 911, and I was able to say, I'm unsafe, and I was able to experience help arriving. And
yeah, yeah. Cole, thank you, Sam. Cole, we've got about 10 minutes.
Okay.
What I want to do is, we've gone, you know, tight close-up on Seven's experience. What I'd like to now is broaden out to what is the current state of this research? How does it fit in the context of wider psychedelic research? Where are we going? Those sorts of things in the final 10 minutes to kind of give people a sense. And by the way, I mentioned at the top, and I will mention again, Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, really goes into his personal experiences and the wider context. One thing is that Michael chose not to deal with MDMA. Mm. In his book, it's LSD, it's psilocybin, and so on. And one of the reasons, I think, is that MDMA is different enough that there are some people who say it's not a psychedelic.
Right.
Talk to that.
Yeah, molecularly, it isn't in the same sort of family tree as the classic psychedelics that
mescaline,
people think of.
Mescaline, LSD, psilocybin.
Interestingly, mescaline actually is closer related. It's to MDMA and the amphetamine groups, phenethylamines. There's an antidepressant that's a phenethylamine that comes from this sort of family tree of molecules. And the tryptamine molecules would be like DMT, psilocybin. LSD isn't really a tryptamine, but it's closer to that relationship. You talked about Shulgin. So Shulgin's two big works are phenethylamines that I have known and loved and tryptamines that I have known and loved, TCAL and PCAL, about his
and when
work
he says
making
his work,
those
he doesn't mean his work in the lab. He means these are two books. They're huge.
Yes.
They're like 700 pages each, and
right.
they tell this whole deep story. So, and but the spelling of Shulgin's name is Shulgin.
Right. And so I believe Michael Pollan's particular concern was that MDMA is a stimulant. It's in that amphetamine
right.
family tree technically. And so when he consulted with his doctors and his cardiologists for medical reasons,
he
decided
that's right.
to skip the
yeah.
the MDMA. And it is very different experientially. The tryptamines are sort of known for this ego death experience, an experience outside of oneself or beyond oneself or
without oneself.
Right, exactly. Without oneself and all things. While the MDMA and that is much more seated. It is actually like hyper ego, egoic. It's very much working with the individual experience. It's dealing with the self and the content it's dealing with the self and relationships and
yeah, it's
and
an interesting. So what we were describing before, when we were talking about MDMA, the self acceptance, the acceptance of others,
right.
feelings of bonding. Those are about us,
right?
And
right.
and as you say, the tryptamine family
yeah.
is much more about the loss of ego, the loss of self, and we are the universe at some point, right?
Right.
That sort of ego. Yeah.
Right. And like very much the experiences described are like similar to those of heavy, deep meditators, you know, described in Eastern philosophy
right.
and Eastern religion for millennia.
So the current state of MDMA research.
So the current state of MDMA research, we are about to start phase 3.
And there are 15 sites, right?
There are, yeah, I think
maybe they haven't
settled around 15.
Yeah.
yeah.
And so they're all about to start.
We're all about to get started.
And how long will a stage 3 take?
Stage 3, we're going to likely split into two studies, and each taking about a year is, I think, the current
okay,
projected.
Okay, now the sessions, as Seven described, even though hers wasn't within this this study, it was replicating a very similar situation as a study. Three sessions with some time in between, some time before.
Yeah.
What's the year?
What do you mean?
Why does it take a year?
Because we have to collect a lot of data. Actually, our efficacy data is so strong that statistically, I won't bore you with the statistics, but when your efficacy is very strong, you don't need as much data to prove that it's efficacious. But we do have to have a sort of a minimum amount of safety data,
mm-hmm.
at least.
Sure.
So
sure. And the goal is within yeah. how long might MDMA be actually taken from is it stage one? What's it called?
Schedule one.
Schedule one, which
yeah.
is dangerous with no useful purpose,
right,
to actually being something that might be prescribed with therapy. What's the hope?
The hope is that the data will look as good as that phase two data, and by 2021 is the
okay.
is the sort of target date.
Yeah, that's very soon. I do want to step to one other thing, which I mentioned in your work and which I know is part of your work, which is your work with ketamine and depression. Talk about that.
Yeah, so ketamine is already a prescribable medication. It's been...
So it went through the process we're describing with MDMA over the last 10 or so years?
So actually... It's kind of got its own pretty cool story. I'll try to tell it quickly. It came from the field of anesthesia. So it's been an anesthetic. It's on the World Health Organization's list of essential drugs. If you're opening a medical system in a fledgling country, you know, this is on the list of drugs you absolutely have to have. It's the go-to anesthetic for particular pediatrics, newborns and children. It's the anesthetic of choice a lot of times because it's got an enormous safety window. And so it was already in the toolkit for doctors.
Right.
But
since this was a new use.
Right, exactly.
But the safety didn't have to be proven. They discovered
that. Yeah. So the safety had already been demonstrated. It's already an FDA approved drug. And so this would be considered off-label use, which happens all the time, by the way, in psychiatry. Yeah. That's like not abnormal. And so there are a propensity of data suggesting that it's helpful for, you know, such a huge, you know, global problem as depression.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of data now, and there isn't likely going to be phase three. So waiting around for that kind of thing to happen. It's not going to happen
because
it's already got a use. It's off patent. So the finances just aren't there to fund a $30 to $100 million study.
Will that negatively impact its adoption?
I think that it has certainly slowed it. I think it's somewhat of a risk for someone to take because there's no governing agency willing to step in and say, like, here's how you use ketamine for depression. Nobody's willing to sort of this FDA process, as cumbersome as it can be, it really defines how it's used along with the way that it is brought to market.
Right.
So in hopefully 2021, the way that it's being used in this study, that's the protocol that's been shown safe and effective. Everyone can rely on that data.
That's the MDA you're talking about.
Yeah. With the ketamine, we don't have that luxury of it having gone through that whole process. And so there's no buddy who sort of has the authority to make you know, the everyday psychiatrist
feel comfortable,
like this is exactly how we use it.
So even though it's already being prescribed, there isn't a hard and fast protocol to make people feel comfortable with shifting over to using it.
Right. There's a lot of data to sort of point in a direction of how to use it. And that should be scrutinized by any psychiatrist looking to utilize it. It's very powerful. I would recommend utilizing it if you're a psychiatrist because it really can do wonders for otherwise untreatable conditions.
Right. It's called treatment-resistant, right?
Exactly.
Treatment-resistant depression. This is not just your blues. This is like the stuff that other other substances aren't working with.
Yeah, at least two failed treatments. Yeah.
Okay. So we've got to bring this to a close. I just want to say that there is so much more that we didn't get into in terms of studies that are going with LSD, with psilocybin. I recommend Michael Pollan's book. I recommend MAPS, which is the Multidisciplinary
Association for Psychedelic Studies.
MAPS.org.
Correct.
If you go there, they have material on all these studies, material on all these substances. And if this is something you want to learn about, that is a great source. If you want to see what's making the current sort of situation seem to shift, look at Michael Pollan's book. As I said, the website where you can learn more is MAPS, MAPS.org. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus usually 7 or 8 articles of relevance to that guest, but also to that week, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes, and that's, you know, Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, etc. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Gary Baca and George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. Most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely, and I will be with you soon. Thank you, Seven McDonald.
Thank you, Terrence.
And thank you, Cole Martha.
Thank you so much.
Both of you, keep up the good work.
Whether you're listening to me, Mark Levine, every Monday and Thursday,
or me, Leslie Marshall, each Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday,
you can hear us from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear.
The legislative representative for the United Steelworkers, the USW. We have Anna Fenley joining us. Would you say, in your professional opinion, Anna, that Brett Kavanaugh's record with working people and their families basically shows that Kavanaugh on that bench would be a threat to workers and certainly to OSHA?
Absolutely. I mean, Judge Kavanaugh has what I would consider a dangerous record as far as workers and working people, and his support and his past decisions that have supported the wealthy and supported employers at the expense of working people.
There's also more clear evidence, and I think it's even clearer when you see the kind of checks the Koch brothers are writing to Republicans and to help this guy get on the bench, that Kavanaugh is not just a friend to, but he's over-friendly to corporate America and hostile to workplace safety. So in other words, over-friendly to the rich, the corporations, hostile to the hardworking men and women, the blue-collar, middle-class workers that make up the majority of this nation.
He's been criticized over many years for his so-called activist opinions. And I think that working people expect someone at the Supreme Court to be fair and independent and mainstream. And there are just so many red flags that you've mentioned in a number of areas of issues, but particularly for working people, for their rights to organize, for their rights to a safe workplace. He has a number of cases that are just very concerning that he wrote opinions on during his time on the D.C. Circuit.
I was recently in San Diego, and my children asked me why we couldn't go to SeaWorld. And I told them about what happened in 2010. A killer whale didn't just drown a SeaWorld trainer, he dismembered her. Her name was Dawn Branchow. OSHA proved that SeaWorld and its employees knew from previous incidents and close calls that all of its killer whales were dangerous. Hello, they're killer whales and in tanks, right? And the D.C. court, the circuit court, decided 2-1 in favor of OSHA. The majority's opinion upholding OSHA's action was written by Circuit Judge Judith Rogers, also a judge you may have heard of, Merrick Garland, who was the lone dissenter opposing OSHA's citation, Circuit Judge Brett Kavanaugh. But to me, you're clearly siding with a corporation. You know, this is not a constitutional issue. To me, this is very common sense. You know, either a company should care about its employees, especially when you had this whale on three separate occasions prior bring harm. I mean, after the first of all, the people should have never been in the water with killer whales. And if, in fact, they all felt that they wanted to and SeaWorld felt they were safe, after the first fatality, what was done after Dawn's death should have been done before. But we need to point out that the lone dissenter who opposed OSHA's citation was, in fact, Circuit Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who may be sitting on the highest court in our land in months.
Yeah, it's very terrifying, actually. You know, he said that that trainer who was killed knowingly took the risk that she could violently die like that. And if that's expanded to all, if he gets the opportunity to expand that way of thinking to all workers in this country, I mean, I just can't even imagine what kind of world we'd be living in. It's terrifying.
Again, that's Mark Levine every Monday and Thursday.
And Leslie Marshall each Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday.
3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Hey kids, do you listen to us on ProgressiveVoices.com? Well, as the Progressive Voices audience has grown, so have our bandwidth costs. I mean, we've tried to protect the limited commercial nature of the stream, so to keep up with costs, we need your help. Talking to you, you might say we're victims of our own success. With nearly a million regular listeners, the cost of operating the stream has grown beyond our wildest expectations. If you want to continue enjoying my show and others on the free mobile Progressive Voices platform, pitch in now. Won't you go to progressivevoices.com /donate and hit that donate button. Progressivevoices.com. Do it now.
If you want to continue enjoying great shows like Randy Rhoads, Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, Leslie Marshall, and so many others on the free mobile Progressive Voices platform, please go to progressivevoices.com and press the donate button right now. Thank you.